strike. In a statement, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad group said the Zionist enemy is trying hard to evade its responsibilities for the brutal massacring that it committed by bombing the Baptist Arab National Hospital in Gaza through his usual fabrication of lies and through pointing the finger of blame at the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. In its latest report, the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reveals that 25% of the Gaza Strip's residential buildings have been destroyed in the Israeli airstrikes. Meanwhile, displaced Palestinians gathered at the Church of St. Porphyrius, a Greek Orthodox church in central Gaza City, have been targeted in an Israeli air raid, leading to the martyrdom of tens of Palestinians and injury of many more. The Orthodox Patriarch of Al-Quds expressed his strongest condemnation of the air assault on the church compound in Gaza. The Orthodox Patriarch of Al-Quds said in a statement, "Targeting churches and their institutions, along with the shelters they provide to protect innocent citizens, especially children and women who have lost their homes due to the Israeli airstrikes on residential areas over the past few days, constitutes a war crime and cannot be ignored."
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. It's a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's program, we'll be discussing how Israel's dangerous arms trade facilitated the war in Sri Lanka and the implications of Russia-Ukraine war on India's space programs. So stay tuned. In this episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Israel's role in the Sri Lankan civil war, and we shall also take a look at Chandrayaan 3, India's latest endeavour in lunar exploration. Following the policy of non-alignment, Sri Lanka initially denounced the racist regime of Israel, expressing empathy with the Palestinian Liberation Corps. However, during the time of emergency in the 1980s, when Sri Lanka was refused military help from the US, UK and Germany, the Zionist regime grabbed the opportunity and brokered an arms deal with a South Asian island country. According to conflict analysts, Israel has been the biggest provider of weapons to Sri Lanka, with the arms deal reaching billions of US dollars.
Israeli weapons, including surveillance, unmanned aerial vehicles and other military equipment, were sold to Sri Lanka. According to reports, the Zionist regime provided advanced night vision and communications technology, artillery coordination systems and Gabriel C2C missiles to Colombo. In addition, Israel also supplied SAR 6 class corvette, Shaldak, Dora and Sura vessels to Sri Lanka. Kafir, a dangerous all-weather multi-role combat aircraft, was also a part of the arms sold to the South Asian country. The aircraft was first used by the Israeli army to conduct an air strike in Lebanon in 1977, killing more than 100 innocent people. One of the world's top 10 weapon dealing, the regime manufactures all kinds of weapons from small arms to killer drones. Conflict analysts say the importance of Israel's military-industrial complex is overwhelming for its economy, and to serve its interests, the regime exploits other nations through deceit, Sri Lanka being a prime example. According to experts, taking advantage of Sri Lanka's serious security situation, Israel manipulated the South Asian country for its benefits. With support from the international stakeholders that have their own vested interests in the arms deal, the Zionist regime has been exporting all types of arms to different countries, thus endangering human life.
While China and Pakistan are often blamed for providing help to the Sri Lankan government during the war, there has been a total silence on Israel's footprints in the conflict that devastated the South Asian island country. Multiple reports from international bodies on the arms sales lead to the significant involvement of Israel in the Sri Lankan civil war has not evoked any inquiry from global human rights organizations till today.
Evidence suggests that the Sri Lankan war that lasted for 26 years, killing thousands of people, was assisted by foreign elements. Peace and conflict analysts say that the UN and the Western countries that claim to be the guards of world human rights have maintained a complete silence on Israel's role in the Sri Lankan civil war, probably trying to mask the wrongdoings of the Zionist regime and safeguarding their personal military and economic interests. According to Israeli human rights activists, there is more than enough evidence to justify opening a criminal investigation into the involvement of Israeli companies, officials and private individuals in the crimes committed in Sri Lanka. However, keeping in view the past experience, experts say there is feeble chance of any legal action against regime. Conflict analysts maintain that the failure of the world human rights organizations to seek accountability from the Zionist regime for its crimes against humanity has sent signals that atrocities against innocent people can be continued with impunity. It is important to mention that in recent years, Israel has also supplied arms to the military junta in Myanmar, accused of ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslims. According to foreign affairs experts, Israel has become a weapon supplier to dubious regimes in the world, thus threatening world peace.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Ponsara Amarasinghe from Colombo. He's a researcher at St. Anna School for Advanced Studies. First of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Amarasinghe.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, for all these years, either the government or the LTTE have been blamed for the war crimes in Sri Lanka. So the question is, why has there been a global silence over the role?
Well, you have raised two questions in one, so let me ask them categorically from one by one. And firstly, when it comes to those so-called war atrocities or war crimes committed in Sri Lanka, which seems to be an attempt made by the international community, especially by the Western media propagandas and the Western countries, to tarnish the image of Sri Lanka. Because in reality, realistically, the civil war that took place in Sri Lanka for past 30 years was not a war between the government and the Tamil community, which was rather than a military conflict between a separatist group called LTTE, the Tamil Elam terrorist group, and the government of Sri Lanka, and specifically the Elam group, the LTTE, started the war firstly by not killing the people from the majority, but they started the war by killing the Tamils. And regarding the question that you ask about the global silence over the role of Israel in Sri Lanka, the answer is rather simple, because there have not been open evidence or there have not been much something realistically on the ground regarding the Israelis' role in the country. But in truth, if you look at the statistical information on how Israeli interfered with Sri Lankan military conflict that dates back to the 1980s, firstly, let me tell you that Israel provided arms and weapons to the government armies of Sri Lanka in various ways. Firstly, it started to train the Sri Lankan armed forces in the 80s. And secondly, it was assisted by the U.S. Embassy in Colombo to start their own research bureau, the embassy section in Colombo, and which dealt with a lot of government affairs within Sri Lanka. But unfortunately, neither Israel nor the government of Sri Lanka have openly affirmed about this role of Lavin in Colombo.
Dr. Amarasinghe, we know about the involvement of Israel in Sri Lanka. So how did Israel get involved, and why Sri Lanka?
Yeah, that's a very pertinent question. I think, as I told you in my analysis, that the Israel Research Bureau was started in 1984, just 1 year after the commencement of the military conflict of Sri Lanka. And initially, the Israelis started training the armed personalities from Sri Lankan Army and Navy Air Forces in Israeli bases. But simultaneously, they were doing something rather dodgy. Because while training the Sri Lankan Army officers, from one side, they provided armed training for the guerrillas came from Sri Lanka as well. Especially if you read Viktor Strosky's By the Way of Deception, the famous the book on the Mossad involvement in South Asia and Eastern Asian campaigns, Trotsky has clearly acknowledged that Israeli armed forces were providing armed training for both Sri Lankan government and also the LTTE guerrillas simultaneously. I mean, that was something really funny from one side. And I would say that after that, throughout the 90s till the arrival of Mahinda Rajapaksa in 2005 to the power, the Israeli government kept providing Kafir jets and also Dora, the equipments, and also the Gabriel C missiles for the Sri Lankan armed forces. And I must acknowledge that those were not the donations, by the way. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of the trade agreement, the armed trade deals between Israel and Colombo government. And because from one side in the 90s, most of the Western countries stopped providing us the arms and ammunition, so Sri Lankan government had no other options except looking for other alternatives, in particular from Israel, because Israel seemed to be a pretty interesting armed trade weapon for the government of Sri Lanka, who did not ask for any of those human rights violations or human rights conditions. So that was pretty simple.
Now, Dr. Amarasinghe, why is there a silence over Israel's dangerous arms sales? The UN and Western countries that claim to be the defenders of human rights in the world have preferred silence over Israel's involvement. Why?
I mean, that's an ironic situation. You can't simply call Western countries as the defenders of human rights if you have realistically looked at the atrocities committed by Americans and the British in places like Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So I would say that it would be a biggest blunder to call them the defenders of human rights. But when it comes to Sri Lankan issues, the Western countries have taken specific stances in human rights alleged violations by the Sri Lankan military forces during the civil war, specifically due to the fact that Sri Lankan government mainly relied on countries such as China, Pakistan, and especially the Russian Federation. Especially, I need to tell you that after 2005, after Mahinda Rajapaksa came to power, Israelis completely stopped selling their armed equipments and the other ammunition for Sri Lankan government, because they feared that Mahinda Rajapaksa's alliance, the closer rapport with countries like Iran and China and Russian Federation, might undermine them in the long run. So basically, the Sri Lankan armed forces fundamentally relied on the military aid came from countries like China and Russia. So at the end of the war, the Western countries have made a tremendous hullabaloo over those issues, especially regarding how China and Russia provided arms and ammunition for Sri Lankan government forces. But they did not talk about the role played by Israelis in the 1980s, because we need to understand, we need to acknowledge, it was Israeli forces, firstly, who helped us to established a special task force, which is called the STF in Sri Lanka, which is something equivalent to Israeli Shin Bet force. So that was actually kept under the Israeli assistance. But since that Israel seems to be a country which has been favored by Washington, the Western countries are reluctant to talk about the Israelis' role in Sri Lankan civil affair, which actually, you know, lies underneath. But on the contrary, they keep criticizing and they keep talking about the contribution made by countries like China, Pakistan, and Russian Federation. I would simply say it's rather hypocritical.
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, some human rights activists have said that there's enough evidence to support criminal investigation against the Zionist regime. Okay? So do you think Israel will be held accountable for its crimes or for what it's done?
I think that if you look at the current political order, whatever the resolution raised in the United Nations can be vetoed by the permanent member states to the United Nations Security Council. So in that case, whatever the resolution comes before the UN always would be automatically vetoed by the US or one of those, the aligned countries to Israel. So I think it is highly unlikely to think about any kind of a criminal investigation against Israel under the current geopolitical scenario. I mean, I know it seems to be pretty unfortunate scenario, but that has been the reality of the global power political regime which you and I are undergoing.
That's right, sir. Thank you, Dr. Amarasinghe, for being on the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Punsara Amarasinghe from Colombo. He's a researcher at Santa Ana School for Advanced Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Vindhya Budhpitiya, an anthropologist working on conflict and visual culture, tweeted, Israeli complicity in Sri Lanka war crimes must be investigated. During the civil war, Israel sold weapons and backed the Sri Lankan army while it was committing grave atrocities. Dr. Mamoon, a science enthusiast, tweeted, Imagine Israel participated in Sri Lanka's government's brutal war against civilians in the civil war. Zionists are thirsty for blood creatures. Parthiban Shanmuganathan, a journalist and media trainer, tweeted, Israel is one of them. In the 2000s, Sri Lanka became one of Israel's most important countries in Asia, undertaking significant procurement of Israeli military technology. Israelis also trained Sri Lankan troops involved in the war. We the People, a Pakistani interested in political, social and economic issues, tweeted, Israel is an outpost of US in the Middle East to intimidate its neighbors for the sake of increasing the sale of arms industry. Western global politics has now been rallied around creating conflicts and war zones. Ukraine is the latest example.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
On July 14, 2023, the Indian Space Research Organization launched Chandrayaan-3, the country's latest endeavor in lunar exploration. Building upon the success of its predecessors, Chandrayaan-1 and 2, this mission aims to achieve a controlled landing on the moon, providing an example of India's commitment towards advancing its presence in the global space community. The mission holds immense geopolitical significance for India, as its success could have far-reaching implications not only for India's space program, but also on regional dynamics.
The launch of the spacecraft marks a pivotal moment in India's space exploration journey. The Chandrayaan-3 mission aims to demonstrate a safe and soft landing on the moon, control rover operations and perform on-site experiments on the lunar surface.
India's space exploration sector has been, it's a miracle, it's a success story, it's one of a kind in the third world. Normally, if you look at the countries who have achieved, milestones as far as space exploration is concerned, you will find the countries either are from the first world or the second world. By second world, I mean Soviet Union and the allied countries. But if you look at India, India has achieved a lot under the constraints. And one of the areas where we can be considered among the top countries in the world is the area of space exploration. Economically also, it gives India a lot of benefit, because India then launches the satellite other countries in space, and it brings in foreign exchange to India, which is a big achievement for a country like India. As far as Chandra campaign is concerned, it was a very ambitious campaign. And we failed once, but we have worked on that. And I believe in years to come, India will be seen as the peer power in terms of peer power when it comes to space and space explorations and related areas.
If successful, this mission will buy India access to an exclusive club that includes the United States, Russia, and China as one of the few nations to achieve a controlled landing on the moon, elevating India's standing in the global space race.
As I said, this gives India's space image a big boost. Why I say a big boost is that already a lot of countries are using India's rockets to have their satellite placed in the orbit. And whether it is a weather satellite or it is a GPS-based satellite, this success will mean that our rockets are powerful enough to go beyond the area where we are operating now, which means that more and more countries will come and hire our rockets for placing their satellites in the orbit of in the orbits. This is a big achievement also in terms of exploration, but also in terms of financial gains. So it is something that India is very proud of, and I hope and believe that this is one of the organizations in India which runs like a first world organization, and I believe that in years to come it will achieve further.
The Chandrayaan lander that weighs 1500 kg carries a 26 kg rover in its belly. In a hope to find something new, the rover will focus on the physical characteristics of the surface of the moon, the atmosphere close to the surface, and the tectonic activity below the surface. The South Pole region of the moon, where the spacecraft aims to land, holds the promise of valuable resources, including frozen water, that could play a crucial role for future space missions.
It is vital because if you look at moon, the thing with moon is that it's a spin on its axis in 27.5 days, but it also takes the moves around the axis of Earth in 27.5 days, which means that if you are at one place in the world, you will only see one face of moon at any given time, because the spinning time is equal to the revolution time is equal to rotation time, which means that the other side of the moon, which we say the dark side of the moon, has not been that well explored. What India is trying to achieve is that to explore the unexplored area, which is the dark side of the moon. Very few countries have managed to explore about it. US and China are probably only two countries which have explored some of the areas on the darker side. So dark side of the moon is an area which is largely unexplored, and India wants to explore that aspect of moon. It will have a great scientific benefit, not only for India, but also for the entire scientific world.
India's successful landing in this region can attract attention from other space organizations and private space companies seeking to tap into the potential resources. According to Indian space scientists, the ultimate goal for India's probes is to find a possibility for Moon to become an extended continent of the Earth.
In the world arena, in the years to come.
With its remarkable achievements in low-cost Asian, India's space agency has long been a source of pride for the South Asian country. However, the Ukraine conflict and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Russia by the United States have cast a shadow over India's space endeavors. While the conflict has primarily affected Ukraine and Russia, its geopolitical ripples extend beyond the borders. Strategic relations experts say India, a traditional partner of Russia in the realm of space cooperation, will also have to bear the brunt of these sanctions.
Traditionally, space cooperation has remained immune to geopolitical tensions. However, the war in Ukraine has introduced a new dynamic. Through the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the United States has been trying to isolate Russia from its allies. Over the years, India has enjoyed a fruitful partnership with Russia, collaborating in various domains, including space flight, satellite navigation, launch vehicle development, and planetary exploration. Foreign relations experts say escalating sanctions could hit India's importation of space-related equipment from Russia.
See, as of now, there is very little or no impact. It is because, the space program of Russia vis-a-vis its collaboration with India has not been sanctioned. That part has been kept out of sanction because the deals were struck with Russia and India pre-Ukraine war deals. Those have been kept out of any kind of sanctions. First thing. Second, India understands its strategic edge over US, where it knows that US needs India for the containment of China. And because US needs India for the containment of China, it gives India some breathing space where it can, in a limited way, dictate some of the policies. And one of these is that beyond a point, India will not follow the unilateral sanctions posed US and EU, because these are not UN sanctions. These are unilateral sanctions. So as you can understand, even in the case of oil import, India is not abiding by US unilateral sanction as far as Russia is concerned. The same thing is happening in other areas. So as of now, space exploration is one area where this sanction has not had no impact as of now. What will happen in future will be the course of war, and we would get to know it in months to come.
In addition to the impact of sanctions, India faces a challenge of physical damage to production facilities in Ukraine. Reports indicate that facilities storing hardware critical to Indian Space Research Organization may have suffered damage during the conflict. Furthermore, the reliance on Russia for astronaut training and access to the International Space Station adds another layer of complexity to India's space endeavors.
And now let's go to social media and see what people have to say about India's space exploration.
Sunegor Khade is an interested in technology. Chandrayaan 3rd is a historic mission that will pave the way for future Indian space exploration. I'm excited to see what new discoveries the mission will make. What are you most excited to learn from the Chandrayaan 3? SAR Foundation, an NGO educating children for economically weaker sections, tweeted, Yellow Room children witnessed the historic launch of ISRO's third lunar exploration mission. Chandrayaan 3 scheduled at 2:35 p.m. on Friday. India's commitment to space exploration elevates the dreams and ambitions of every Indian, especially children. Mona, a netizen whose bio says hate and division have no place in a healthy society, tweeted, India considers Russia a time-tested ally from the Cold War era with key cooperation in defense, oil, nuclear energy and space exploration. Luna Politics, a page where economics and politics intersect with the moon, tweeted, Russian analysts suggest BRICS countries cooperate on lunar and deep space exploration.
And that was our episode on Israel's arms sale threatening world peace and the US sanctions on Russia and its implications on India's growing space ambitions. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Andrei Kostin, CEO of Russia's second-largest bank, VTB, has said the Global South should establish a new financial system to mitigate the risks posed by the West. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Andrei Kostin, CEO of Russia's second-largest bank, VTB, told RT on the sidelines of Eastern Economic Forum recently, the dollar and the entire Western financial system built around it has been jeopardized by the sanctions on Russia. Asked about Russia's push towards switching trade to national currencies, Kostin responded that it is done out of necessity rather than a targeted attempt to undermine the greenback. He stated, The dollar is illegally used as a weapon. It should not be done like this. We are talking about finance and the economy. Why should it be used for other purposes than this? It should be free from political and geopolitical risks. That's the only reason for de-dollarization. To illustrate his point, the banker quoted a famous phrase from the Godfather movie, "Finance is a gun, politics is knowing when to pull the trigger." He explained, and that is what we saw. The politicians in the West pulled the trigger and it's been used against Russia. And not only Russia, but other countries. Kostin noted that while a decade ago nobody wanted to use local currencies in cross-border transactions and were content with using the dollar, now more and more countries are re-evaluating this stance. Kostin said, "We raised the question of using local currencies 10 years ago, but nobody wanted it at the time. Why? They said, we can use the dollar. It's good. And it was good until we faced the situation when America started to threaten us, threaten other countries, saying, if you don't do this, if you don't do that, we will cut you off from the dollar. If they had not behaved like this, we would never have raised this question." Kostin said that it is high time for countries in the global south to create their own financial system based on national currencies. He stated, "It is the right time for the global south to start to build up this system because though the global south removed the colonial system politically after the Second World War, the colonial system in the financial sector still exists. The empire built by the US with the help of its allies still works." Kostin added that it is now very clear to the most of the world that if we continue like this, there will be a threat of the US using the financial system as a weapon. The banker noted, however, that the idea is not to fight the Western financial system, but to build a parallel system that will work to the benefit of the global South. He said, "We see big changes in the balance of economic power in the world with such countries as China, Arab countries. And that allows us to create a different system which would be based on different principles. Principles of independence, sovereignty, the use of currencies other than the dollar and euro." Kostin first outlined his idea for a new financial system at the Financial Congress, organized by the Russian Central Bank in July. His proposal included four primary principles: replacing SWIFT with a new messaging system, replacing US-linked correspondent relationships among banks with horizontal links among local banks based on blockchain technology, creating an international depository settlement hub in the Persian Gulf to replace EU-based Euroclear and Clearstream, and creating new instruments for raising capital instead of using foreign currency bonds that are linked to the West. According to Sputnik, the process of de-dollarization on a world scale will be neither a fast nor an easy one, but it is definitely possible in the future, the dean of the Faculty of International Relations at New Era University said. Speaking on the sidelines of the Eastern Economic Forum, EEF, Carlos Tabunda noted that de-dollarization has become the buzzword of late amid the tectonic shifts taking place in the global economic order. Participants of Russia's 8th Eastern Economic Forum, EEF, hosted in the city of Vladivostok from September 10 to 13th, have similarly been weighing in on the prospects of cutting back global reliance on the greenback, Sputnik reported. Many countries remain tightly linked to the American greenback, said the Philippine expert, which explains why the de-dollarization process is still a big challenge. China and Russia, along with other nations spearheading the de-dollarization process, still have a long way to go before reliance on the greenback can be toppled, Tabunda continued. Ways to sidestep the dollar and Western-dominated financial institutions via expanded trade in local currencies have been among the key items on the agenda of last month's three-day summit of the BRICS group of major emerging economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which wrapped up on August 24th in Johannesburg. The gathering ended with an announced expansion with Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Ethiopia, Argentina, and the UAE invited to join the club. At the event, BRICS stressed the importance of encouraging the use of local currencies in international trade and financial transactions between members of the group as well as their trading partners. This shift from dollar use took on a new significance amid expanded weaponization of the major reserve currency by Washington in order to achieve its geopolitical objectives. Furthermore, the dollar's increasingly perilous global position amid prospects of a recession in the United States has also fueled the dollar-ditching debate.
Welcome back to Aperture. We looked into the life of Muhammad Iqbal from his birthplace in Punjab province of British India, now in Pakistan, to his academic studies in the University of Cambridge. Iqbal was a very learned man who was known for his political ideologies and philosophical theories. He is fondly remembered as a great poet and scholar. The political content of Muhammad Iqbal's poetry is one of the most fascinating aspects of his work. Except for a few poems, his entire poetic endeavor is tinged with the political concerns of his time. Both domestic and international political events shaped his poetry. He not only responded to political events in his verse, but also inspired his fellow Indian Muslims through his poetry to find a way out of the political dilemma in which the British colonial rule had put them. Stay with us as we looked into how Iqbal helped his fellow Indian Muslims aspire to a better future and guided them on the road to freedom.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the Royal Falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
شاعری کے مختلف ادوار ہیں.
Allama's poetry consists of certain periods. His poetry was at first as the poetry of the day. He would say at that time, my Urdu poems are like a building made of clay. Little by little, his Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Name, or perhaps with What Can Be Done, O Eastern People.
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture, is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains: Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western thoughts domain.
There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations. Because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Saadi.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words, but also over various meanings, meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, there is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein.
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems and such verified stories as The Souvenir of Hijaz, The Eastern Message, The Familiar Secrets, and The Mysteries of Rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things and idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new worldview into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you?
Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, to a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self.
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. The house, quiet corner, became a place for those who wish to fly faults of self-belief, something much needed by all.
The house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native land's people. My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkli district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall harden ourselves to become a human being, Paul Excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for himself, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
Sign. signs of going senile can be seen very easily in me. The tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I to reach the end of the line. Oh, the memory of those days when time's sword was allied with the strength of our hands and unveiled the face of truth. Our nails tore loose the knot of this world. Our bowing in prayer gave blessings to the earth. From the jar of truth we made rosy wine gush forth. We charged against the ancient taverns.
اس گھر کی تعمیر ہماری دادی کی خواہش پہ کی گئی تھی پر وہ اس گھر میں
دس ہاؤس واز بلٹ انڈر مائی گرینڈ مدرز وش
ان کی یہاں پہ بیمار
بٹ اونلی فار ٹو اور تھری ڈیز شی لیفٹ ہیئر
چوتھے دن وہ وفات پا گئی تو اس کے بعد
شی واز سیک وین دے کیریڈ ہر ان اے کار
معمول بنا لیا
تھا بٹ شی سروائیوڈ اونلی فار ٹو اور تھری ڈیز
میرے والد تب 11 سال کے تھے جب ان کی والدہ فوت
ایٹ دی ایج اف 11 مائی فادر لاسٹ ہز مدر وین مائی آنٹ واز اباؤٹ 6 ایئرز اولڈ
معمول بنا لیا تھا کہ وہ دونوں بچے والد اور
مائی فادر اینڈ مائی آنٹ وڈ کم ہیئر ایوری ڈے ٹو سی علامہ ہو واز لائنگ آن دس بیڈ
دروازے میں کھڑے ہو جاتے تھے
علامہ کالڈ دیم اینڈ مائی آنٹ وڈ کم اپ ٹو علامہ اینڈ مائی فادر وڈ سٹ آن دی ادر سائیڈ اف دی بیڈ This way Alama would feel comfortable.
لیٹ جاتی تھی علامہ صاحب کے اس طرح والد لیٹ جاتے تھے
میں ان کے چلی جاتی تھی شام کے وقت شام ہونی تو اسکول سے آ کے
I usually went to see them after school.
میں نے تو ان کو اسی عادت
Alama was always lying on his bed and resting.
میں پاس جا کے لیٹ جاتی تھی تو وہیں پہ سارے مہمان
I was always beside him.
ہر وقت لوگوں
other people would also go there.
ملنا ملانا مسلسل ہی جاری رہتا تھا
اس گھر میں کئی لوگ علامہ کو ملنے آ چکے ہیں قائد اعظم محمد علی جناح
مینی کیم ہیئر ٹو سی ہیم
محمد علی
امانگ دیم جنرل محمد علی جناح جواہر لال نہرو محمد علی جوہر اینڈ مینی ادر انٹیمیٹ فرینڈز آف علامہ
علامہ صاحب اپنے بستر پہ بیٹھتے تھے اور
دے وڈ کم ہیئر جسٹ بیفور اور آفٹر میڈ ڈے ٹو ہیو اے چیٹ ود علامہ اباؤٹ ٹاپکس لائک پوئٹری فلاسفی اور اینی ادر تھنگز
تو یہ علامہ کی زندگی
علامہ اسپینٹ ہز لاسٹ ڈیز آف لائف ہیئر
وہ اس گھر میں گزرا
I was well aware that the main reason why India went under the yoke of British colonization was lack of knowledge of self and reliance on others. Self-awareness springs out self-dependence and internal richness. Know yourself. Know your hidden parts, nurture your parts, and create a new world, which will compensate for old shortcomings and soul defects, to pave the way for comprehensive development. It is the self which originates existence. It is self-awareness which gives birth to human values. It is the self which affects existence. What human beings see or intuit is a manifestation of the self through mysteries. The form of existence is an effect of the self. Whatsoever thou seest is a secret of the self.
در اقبال آنچه که ما می‌بینیم فلسفه عینی هست. او فلسفه
اقبال's philosophy is objective and tangible.
بالا یا مابعد طبیعی در واقع
He pulls down philosophy from the metaphysical world to make it tangible and applicable to common people.
استفاده برای حتی مردم
اقبال's philosophy is therefore a practical philosophy.
اقبال یک فلسفه عملی هست.
It can be put into practice.
شاید اون رو
O Muslims, you have to preserve your own self. You must follow God and His book, the Holy Quran. When you achieve success in making your own self, you can resist even the whole world. No one can harm you. What is the basis of survival? Survival is based on making your own self. It is the self the nature mentioned by Quran. And this is the essence of Iqbal's thoughts. This is what Iqbal means of the concept of self. For that very reason, every member of the Islamic world should know this way of thinking, personally and socially.
Today we see a group of ignorant people who commit, under the name of Islam, the most heinous acts. Though they are all against Islamic teachings, In fact, they are all Satan's companions and toys in the hands of those who want to mislead them. About these people, Iqbal says, Europe very well knows how to secure interests. While granting to this takes a loan of that, it gives sustenance to Satan in a way that leaves perplexed even God.
Nowadays, there are calculated plots against Islam. The enemy is very active to destroy the Islamic world from within. I personally think that we need Iqbal's ideas about Islam now more than ever before. You are simultaneously a learned man, a Sayyid, a descendant of the Prophet. But tell me, are you a Muslim too?
A Muslim is called infidel by another Muslim. It is not a non-Muslim who calls him infidel. It is a Muslim. All problems are created and spread here and there by those who are pursuing only their own interests.
The phrase which brings unity to you all is, there is no God but Allah. As Iqbal says, the key to our unity, salvation, and survival, and a sign of familiarity, is in this phrase, there is no God but Allah. Those who follow this phrase never behead Muslims. Iqbal's basic philosophy is that all of us should be unified. All of us should form one single family. Muslims should get unified to guard the sanctuary. I mean Muslims from the Nile shores to the city of Kashgar.
Iqbal tells us to put aside personal interests and to move into a direction leading to social interests. Put aside your personal interests. Let's talk about our religion, our unity. We will end in success. Just because of his thoughts, Iqbal is living on today. I think so.
Just have a look at the tragic events caused by a group of people who are Muslims in name only, as if there has never been a person like Iqbal. His philosophy has sunk into oblivion, as if Iqbal never lived among us. This is a great sorrow, casting a shadow over all Iqbal's philosophy and thoughts. There is no memory of him anymore. The light of all his great books has gone out. The everlasting letter, the familiar secrets of rapture, the Persian Psalms, what can be done, O people of the East, the rout of philosophy in Iran, the Eastern message, and reconstructing Islamic religious thoughts. During his last days, Allama says, as Iran, full of unknown meaning, I am unable to endure censurers' sayings. Neither have I any option, nor am I coerced. I am but a living soil, always in revolution.
Then came the last night of Allama's life. His two children came to have their last look at him. Allama was still conscious. Someone from Germany had come to see him, a friend of his or his teacher. The German called the two children and hugged them. My father was leaving the room, but my aunt wasn't. She wanted to stay with him for a while.
At the time, I felt I had to stay with Allama and to sit there motionlessly. Our tutor, Aunt Doris, came there to take me with her. I told her, I will stay here at least for a while.
Allama told the tutor,
she knows that this is the last meeting between the father and the daughter. That is why she doesn't want to leave. Let her stay.
She knows this is the last time she sees her father.
And finally, I felt something was going to happen. For that very reason, I didn't want to leave the place.
Early in the morning, Allama passed away. The muezzin was calling out the morning adhan. Here, beside this bed, was standing his close friend, Ali Bakhsh. There were some other friends too, although most of them were saying their morning prayers at the mosque at that time. Back then, the mosque was more like a house than anything else. Friends were there to say their prayers in congregation. After their prayers, Allama passed away. His last words were the two testimonies. Then his soul flew to the sky. I personally suppose people like Allama will come to this world several centuries later.
Allama Iqbal Lahori died at the age of 61 on April 21, 1938, after a life of diligence and hard work. In the last moments of his life, he put his hand on his chest, telling Ali Bakhsh, his man, "I have a pain here." And upon uttering